My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. Thanks for joining us. This episode, we dive into the world of cryptozoology with Britain's Richard Freeman. Richard is someone whose work I have admired for a long time, so it was great to finally have the opportunity to discuss a variety of cryptids from around the world with him. He has travelled the world investigating some of the most intriguing creatures, as well as authoring a variety of books, articles and essays, both in his own name and as the Zoological Director for the Centre of Fortean Zoology, based here in the UK. But before we dive in, I just wanted to congratulate one of our biggest supporters, Jonathan Gerlock, and his wife Sarah, on their wedding. Congratulations to you both. Those honeymoon pictures look absolutely wonderful. I hope you have a great time. Right, don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube. Please rate and review us on whichever podcast provider you use to help us grow. You can subscribe and support us on Patreon at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. And if you've got any thoughts or guest suggestions, please email at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. Right then, let's go monster hunting with Richard Freeman. My guest today is British cryptozoologist, author, and the Zoological Director for the Centre for Fortean Zoology, Richard Freeman. Richard is an acclaimed member of the Fortean community and has undertaken several expeditions to investigate several cryptids across the world, and has a new book being released in June entitled Adventures in Cryptozoology. Richard, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I'm looking forward to this, diving into the world of cryptids for a bit, so... How long have you been sort of fired up by cryptozoology and trying to discuss and increase the knowledge about certain creatures around the world, Richard?
Ever since I was 14. Get it? Ever since I was 14.
Very good.
No, back when it all started back in the early 70s with watching Doctor Who.
Yeah.
The real Doctor Who, not the shit they're showing now.
Yeah.
With John Pertwee,
yeah,
the great John Pertwee, and Tom Baker. And in those days, in the John Pertwee era, he was trapped on Earth by the Time Lord, so he couldn't go into outer space. So all the creatures he encountered were on your doorstep. They were mostly in modern-day Britain. So you had giant green maggots oozing out of slag heaps in Wales, and you had intelligent marine dinosaurs, and... the Autons, which were these Lovecraftian aliens that animated dummies and made children's toys and shoproom dummies come to life and attack people. Yeah. And it was so scary and weird and bizarre. I first got my interest in mysterious creatures. That's what really, really fired me up back in the day. And of course now, Doctor Who doesn't exist anymore. It's just... a platform for social justice warriors to bleat about political correctness, and every episode is a ham-fisted lesson in political correctness. And I stopped watching the BBC altogether with that, and the way they are so grotesquely prejudiced against Labour, are constantly kissing the arses of the Tory Party. You're not getting any more of my money. So that was the end for the BBC. I won't watch it ever again. But also back in the day, stuff, but David Attenborough's stuff, like The World About Us and Life on Earth. He did a series called Fabulous Animals. It's never been repeated and never been released on DVD, which was all about legendary beasts and cryptozoology. And that's really what got me started. And I left school and I wanted to become a zookeeper. Everybody said, oh, you'll never become a zookeeper. You can't do that. So I went out and became a zookeeper. And I became the head of reptiles at Twycross Zoo. And later on, many years later, I discovered a little magazine called Animals and Men, which wasn't quite as rude as it sounded. And it was the Centre for 14 Zoologies magazine. And I was at university, because I was a mature student when I was at university. And I started writing for them, and then I started to ring them up and having conversations with John Downes, the director. And he said, when you finished at university, come on down and be the zoological director. So once I finished uni, I moved down from Yorkshire to Devon, and the rest is history. I've been all around the world looking for all sorts of bizarre creatures.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, it is, I think, because I'm a couple of years younger than you, so I kind of grew up in the same era in regards to to the thing. And obviously for me, my touchstone was the Arthur C. Clarke first series.
Yes, it was great.
And it was that that kind of
I watched it all again recently.
I mean, that's that. And I was talking to Dr. David Clark the other week, and we were both reminiscing fluently about our love for both series. And that was the thing for me. It just fired me up, and I just thought, wow, this is a wonderful world out there that we're just not being told about. And it just, after seeing the Patterson Gimlin film and, you know, Loch Ness and things like that, I just thought, this is the thing for me. So I think we were very lucky, to be fair, because it kind of disappeared a lot towards the later 80s. So if you'd missed anything, you know, late 70s, early 80s, you were kind of underrepresented, I think, till about the mid-90s after the X-Files boom. And then everything kind of got, people got interested again, didn't they?
They did. I mean, there's a guy called Bob Fisher who wrote a great article 14 times a couple of years ago called about the 70s. He called the 70s the haunted decade.
Yes.
Because of all that bizarre stuff.
Yeah, it was a great article. That as a 14 times subscriber, I often, you know, I read mine cover to cover several times. My partner would love me to move my back issue somewhere less less constricting, I think. But I've go back to issue 64 now, so I'm quite proud of that. It's just a magazine that's always. Oh, sorry, Richard, carry on.
I'm just saying that they do build up, because where I live, I've got very limited space, and I'm a bibliophile. I have thousands of books and magazines. And have you ever seen that? The series Life of Grime.
Yes.
There was that old guy, Mr. Trebus, and he got all his rubbish piled up. I'm like that with books. All my bookshelves are full, so every available surface out on the floor has got piles of books on them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm getting that way, to be honest. I think I've bought six this month on a variety of subjects. I've put a pre-order in for yours, because I'm really looking forward to that, Richard, as well. So That's definitely one that'll be arriving next month as well. So I'm not far behind you, I think.
Brilliant.
So, in regards to this, obviously you've been very fortunate enough to travel the world looking for certain cryptids, and there's a few that I want to kind of discuss in a bit more in depth, really. And I'm going to start with probably the one I think. And you may say disagree, and you're quite welcome to, Richard. The one I think we're probably going to find more first before one of the other ones pops up, unless something dramatic happens, is the Orang Pendek.
Yes, that and the Tasmanian wolf are the two. Either one of them, I think, may be discovered any day.
I mean, it's the Orang Pendek is something that I've always had a fascination in. I think I once read something in the 90s. It might have been an article in the 14 Times, but obviously since then, with the birth of the internet and YouTube and things, there's obviously a lot more information about that. And obviously getting to know people like Adam Davis and the work he's done looking for it, obviously, over the last 20 years or so. And is it Debbie Marter as well, I think, probably one of the most well-known investigators and people, because she, I think she actually, doesn't she live out in Sumatra now?
Yes, she went over there originally as a travel journalist, ended up staying, heard about the orang pendek, didn't think it was real, and then saw it about a month later. She had a very good sighting of it, and she's had several other sightings since. And she's now the head of the Indonesian Tiger Conservation Group.
Mm. Well, yeah, because it's supposed to live in the same area that the Sumatran tiger is, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So how many times... go on, sorry, Richard.
The main place it's seen these days is Kerinci Sabmat National Park in the west of Sumatra.
Yeah, I mean, so how many times have you been out there?
I've been out there 5 times now.
Wow.
And I've heard the creature calling. Mm. I've found its footprints and its handprints, which are completely distinct from other apes, totally unlike an orangutan's. The handprints are totally unlike an orangutan, and the footprints. I found hair that's been examined by Lars Thomas of Copenhagen University, and he says that it is related to but distinct from the Sumatran orangutan, and he's forced to conclude that there is a large unknown primate in the area. And my mate, Adam Davis, sorry, not Adam Davis, although he has been on a number of the exhibitions, my mate, Dave Archer, and our guide, the late Sahar Dimas, actually saw the creature. The day, it was his first expedition, his first day in the rainforest, and he sees it.
Oh.
And he described this creature sitting in a tree. It was as large as a big chimpanzee. It had thick black hair, rather like a mountain gorilla. Its face was strikingly human-like, and it climbed down from the tree and walked off on its hind legs.
Yeah. I mean, that's not something you missed. I mean, the chances of, I mean, the amount of people that have been out there looking for it to turn up on your first day, on your first expedition, that's just showing off, isn't it?
Yeah. It is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, It's something that I know that the usual excuses are put forward in regards to, you know, obviously natives people, they just make things up. I think tends to be quite a lot of sceptical argument about this, which I find quite disrespectful, is the politest
way. It's ridiculous. Though they have things to do than make up stories. Mm. Native people, we don't really appreciate this in the West. And sceptics, you know, they're always stay-at-home people. They're always armchair people.
Mm.
They don't really get that native people, they're living hand-to-mouth. And they've got better things to do than make up stories about monsters.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, I mean, out there in Sumatra is, you know, like you say, these people have got better things to do than try and bamboozle and create mischief. I know that the, is it the Sokoanak Dalam population that live out there? They consider them as partners in the land, don't they?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, those people. We've talked to a couple of chieftains that have both seen. One of them said he was out hunting and he was up in a tree and he saw one of them walk into a forest clearing, and he watched it for about 15 minutes. And another guy, he said he'd seen one in an old graveyard that used to be a butt to the rainforest, and he said it stood up from behind a gravestone. He thought it was a ghost at first. He saw this grey hair-covered ape-like creature walking on its hind legs. And another one, he was just walking through the forest when he saw it.
Yeah.
He said he hid behind some rattan vines, and he said this thing was about 4 feet tall, it had a face like a monkey, but it was walking upright like a man.
Yeah. I mean, that's what distinguishes it as well from an orangutan, because the majority of witness reports, I know quite a few people refer to seeing them in trees or, you know, going up and down trees, but quite a lot of the sightings are them walking bipedally on the forest floor, which is something orangutans just don't do.
No, well, the male Sumatran orangutan, when he comes to the forest floor, does walk erect, but it's very rare they do come to the forest floor.
Mm.
And its style of walking is completely different. It walks on the edges of its feet. Pardon me, I've got a terrible cough.
That's all right.
It walks on the edges of its feet, whereas the orang pendek walks like a man with its foot flat down. And the footprints are completely different. They have broad, human-like heels, three toes at the front and an offset big toe. And the handprints are different to known species of orangutan. They're much more like the handprint of a gorilla. Orangutans have very small thumbs and very, very long fingers. This has thick, sausage-like fingers and a larger thumb. Now, I've worked with all the great apes, and I can tell you that this is something distinct, completely distinct.
Has there been much reports of them using, obviously, because one would suspect then, you know, with a larger thumb, that would indicate some kind of ability to build, if you know what I mean.
Well, all apes use tools to a certain extent. They'll pick up rocks and throw them, and they'll use sticks as clubs and things, but they don't fashion tools like hominins do, like the ancestors of man and the relatives of the ancestors of man. The orang pendek, it will throw sticks and stones, but it doesn't really fashion tools. The smart money is that it is a undiscovered species of orangutan. Now, orangutans evolved on this landmass called Sundar or Sundaland, not Sunderland up near Newcastle. It's when the Malayan Peninsula was joined to Sumatra, Borneo and Java. The Bornean orangutan and the Sumatran orangutan already split off and speciated before the ocean levels dropped and the area became islands. So they'd already speciated over 400,000 years ago. And recently a new species of orangutan was discovered on Sumatra, the Tapa Nui orangutan. There's only about 700 of them left, and the Chinese want to build a dam right through their habitat. But all these orangutans had speciated already thousands of years ago. So I think the orangutan beck is a species of orangutan that's adapted to live on the forest floor rather than in the trees.
I mean, it doesn't, it's no real stretch of the imagination to consider that kind of possibility. And I think that we've discovered over the last 20 years three different types of hominids. I mean, the most recent was about 3-4 weeks ago, wasn't it, when they found the Homo azuazensis, the newly discovered hominid?
I mean, we know that all of these things were knocking around. There were so many more relatives of the ancestors of man than we thought before. And genetically, we've seen that there are markers on African people that suggest that their ancestors mated with an unknown species of hominid. And there are similar markers on people from New Guinea that suggests that they mated with an unknown hominin, one we don't even have the bones for yet, we don't have the fossils for yet. And recently there was two new species discovered in Red Deer Cave in China, and they haven't been given a name yet, these species, but they were knocking around only 10,000 years ago. And it seems that they're more closely related to Homo habilis than Homo erectus. Like the Homo floresiensis, the tiny little hobbits from the island of Flores, they were more closely related to Homo habilis than they were to Homo erectus. Homo erectus was our own ancestor and the ancestor of the Neanderthals. And so habilis, we didn't think even left Africa. So now we know it had relatives, you know, halfway around the world. And, and Homo habilis died out about 1.9 million years ago. But it must have left Africa and speciated and spread across the globe, leaving more species behind it, probably ones we haven't even discovered yet. Which begs the question, you know, are any of these things still about? The editor of Science magazine, Henry G., said he wouldn't be in the least surprised if someday from somewhere like Vietnam or Sumatra he gets evidence that one of those things is still around.
I mean, it for me it seems quite sensible to believe that you know, 25 years ago, there was humans and Neanderthals, and that was it. And we now know that there are five, because we've obviously got the Denisovians as well. That, you know, 10 years ago, nobody even knew who they were. They were suspected that they might be some kind of hominid of some description. But I think a lot of people, when they were first discovered, probably perhaps thought, well, this is probably some Neanderthal archaeology fossilization here. But obviously, since that, they've been able to examine the fossils correctly and put them under rigorous tests, it's proved that they are a completely separate species. And I mean, they found a jawbone the other day in Nepal, which was completely, nobody expected them to be anywhere else outside of Russia. So it just changes week on week at the minute, it seems.
It does. But if you listen to skeptics, they'll say, oh, well, this is rubbish, it doesn't matter, there's no such thing. They're all liars, they're all mistaken, people are just seeing bears. I mean, I was on one forum recently, you know, suggesting that the Yowie in Australia, that's big muscly men dressing in gorilla costumes. If that's the case, there must have been a group of these men, an ongoing group of these men, that have been dressing in gorilla costumes since the time of the first white settlers. Mm. And then before that, into the Aboriginal times. And the average gorilla costume is not at all convincing.
No.
If you want a convincing gorilla costume, like Bolo in The Mighty Boosh, it costs hundreds and hundreds of pounds. The ones you rent from shops, they're garbage. They wouldn't fool anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Yowie is another one that I could talk to you about for hours, Richard, because that's probably another one where I was speaking to a gentleman a couple of weeks ago who's a full-time Yowie hunter out there. And I've always found it fascinating, more so because of the witnesses, because unlike some sort of Bigfoot or Almasty sightings, the majority of people who tend to talk about seeing a Yowie, they sound absolutely terrified. And that's what that's what differentiates it from me, because there's an underlining emotional response to what's happened to them. It goes beyond someone just pulling your leg.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I'm familiar with some of these reports. Who was it you were talking to? I might have known him.
It's a gentleman called Dan. He's down in Queensland, but he tends to be known as Yowie Dan.
No, I don't know that guy.
Yeah. But I know a couple of... He's been at it for about 15 years, but it was I've just found it a really intriguing subject. Like I say, and it's along with the Orang Peng deck. It just makes common sense that we just need to identify these things more scientifically, because we know that things keep turning up now. There's no turning away from it, Richard.
No, more of them are turning up all the time in the fossil record. And some of them are very, very recent as well. Now, the Russians took this so seriously back in the 1950s that they had a commission to look for it. And the commission eventually, it was based at the Dalton Museum in Moscow, and they sent out expeditions. It was disbanded after a few years, but they took it seriously enough to have a commission. Now the commission has been reinstated.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I mean, the Almasty, I mean, I think the best thing footage we saw of that was the video that came out about 5 or 6 years ago from the young lad. Was it Yevgeny Aznimov who'd filmed it? I think it was in Kemerov down in Siberia, who filmed the footprints and then the thing lurking behind the trees. I just found that absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, it's inconclusive. It's not clear enough to say, unlike the Patterson footage, which I think is genuine, this footage isn't clear enough to say, you know, one way or the other.
I think it's a lot of mucking about to try and perpetuate a hoax, though.
It is, yeah.
You know, and it's I think at the time these were 11-year-old boys, you know, middle of winter. Siberia is not the kind of place you go mucking about miles from home, in my opinion.
No.
Especially in winter, because,
you
know.
Yeah, but I've hunted the Almaty in the Caucasus Mountains in Russia.
Yeah. So.
And I talked to a number of witnesses there, and one of them was a geologist who was the deputy head of Elbrus National Park, and he had seen one of these things. He'd been out looking for lost sheep, and he saw what he thought was a cow lying down, and then it stood up. It was like this huge, huge man, huge hair-covered man. It walked right up the mountain. And there was a Ukrainian biologist I went out with, out there with, called Grigory Panchenko, and he had seen one from a distance of only 10 feet when he was hiding in a barn. Another guy who's an archaeologist had seen one. And they take it as read that this is an actual animal. They don't think it's any more fantastical than a bear or a wolf. And they won't shoot it because they think it's a primitive form of man. But when you go over there and talk to some of the witnesses, they don't understand why you've come all the way from England just to look for it. It'd be like them coming all the way to Britain to look for badgers.
Yeah.
Which they might have a hard time finding after the bastard Tories call them all, pointlessly.
Yes, very true.
But one of the things I did when I was out there, I staked out an old farmhouse. And I was there with Adam Davis and Dave Archer, the guy that saw the orangutan dead. And this old abandoned farm, it consisted of three rooms and a sort of L-shaped veranda running around it. And a few years before, some shepherds had been on this veranda one evening, and the door at the end of the veranda opened, and a 7-foot-plus Almaty was there. And it walked along the veranda, picked a guy up, moved him out of the way, walked to the end and jumped over into the bushes. And Anatoly Serendenko, who was the archaeologist who was on our team, he had seen a grey-haired, tall, 7-foot Almaty walking around this place a few years earlier. So what we did, we set up some camera traps and we put bait out, meat and fruit, and red wine mixed with honey, and we just staked the place out. About 10 o'clock at night, one of the camera traps goes off. It's a flash. I hear a sort of twittering sound like a bird, but it's like the middle of the night. Now, the Almaty is supposed to make this bird-like twittering. Grigory Panchenko had seen one of these things in an old abandoned barn, not the same farm. It was another farm that's long since been torn down. He said it was making a twittering noise like a bird. And one of the other witnesses who had saw it just after the Second World War, she said the one she saw was making this strange twittering noise. So I thought, good Lord, can that be what I think it is? And nothing happened then for ages and ages. And we went inside one of those rooms to get warm around this old stove. And Dave fell asleep on this manky old mattress. And Adam and I were warming ourselves around this stove. And the door to this room was about 7 foot tall. And it was slightly ajar, about 3 or 4 inches ajar. And there was moonlight and starlight streaming through. And from outside, we hear a deep guttural vocalization, sort of bum, 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 bum sort of sound. And I said to Adam, did you hear that? And he nods. And then about 25 seconds later, something walks along the veranda. And it's walking on two legs, because when it passes the door, it blocks out the starlight and the moonlight to a height of 7 foot plus. So I said to Adam, it's out there on the veranda. So we grab our cameras, go rushing out, but whatever it was has disappeared. We had a search around, couldn't find anything. In the morning, we checked the camera traps, and all we've got is vegetation moving about. So, you know, was it an Almaty? I can't say that I saw an Almaty, but it wasn't a bear, because it was moving on its hind legs, and it was fast and silent, whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, the other argument that's always put forward from skeptics is that this whole Bigfoot phenomenon is a modern invention, and that's all there is to it. But the Almaty is probably one of the most early earliest reported hominids in Western literature, because I think reports go back to the 15th century for the Almasti, which, you know, unless lots of people are very fluent in early Russian and Assyric, they're not going to sort of go, oh, that sounds a really good idea, let's try and make that up.
There are stories of the Yeti going back to medieval times. They said it uses a rock, carries a rock that it uses as a weapon. And people today say that the Yeti and relative creatures around the world will use rocks as well. They'll hurl them and to crack the skulls open on yaks and deer and other animals. So that's quite a consistent thing.
Yeah, and I mean, that also links into what we were saying about, you know, orangutans and gorillas and apes will tend to utilise sticks and stones for a variety of reasons. So it would not be beyond the realms of possibility, regardless of which side of the divide, whether, you know, whether it's a descendant of man or is it, if it's more akin to the ape side of the split. Regardless, there's a lot of commonalities there in existing apes to the reports that we get of these unproven ones.
And we've got a couple of last year, in fact, there was a TV vet and naturalist called Mark Evans, and he did this documentary called Lost Kingdom of the Yeti, where he went looking for the Yeti in Bhutan, and he took some water from a pool in a mountain in Bhutan. And they look for eDNA in it. That's environmental DNA. That's where an animal moves through an environment and loses bits of itself or cells and stuff. So you can in recent years, the techniques have become much better for isolating eDNA.
Yeah.
Anyway, they found out that there were a couple of species they didn't expect to find. So it's rare species of mountain goat and mountain sheep. But they also found eDNA from a primate, and this primate shared 99% of its DNA with modern man. So it's something more closely related to modern man than a chimpanzee.
I saw, because I think he did a three-part series prior to that as well, didn't he, with is it Brian Sykes?
Now Brian Sykes himself, if you read his book, this wasn't in the series, but if you read his book, which is well worth a read, he says that he was given all this hair that he looked at, and it turned out to be from wolves or bears or humans or horses. It was all red herrings. But he was given two teeth from the skull of a man named Quit. Now, Quit died in the 1950s, and he was supposed to be the son of Zaina, who was a wild woman, an Almasti, who had been captured in 1850. And she was captured in 1850 and taken to this little village in the western part of the Caucasus. And she was kept on a farm, and she tamed down pretty quickly. And she had her own enclosure outside because she couldn't stand being in a heated house. It'd be too hot for her. And she never learned to speak, but she did all sorts of menial tasks around farm. And she was supposed to have a big flat nose, big brow ridge, thin lips, this ape-like face, black skin, reddish brown hair, drooping breasts, and she was about 6'9" tall, immensely strong. And she would, you know, carry big sacks of flour and grind corn and things like that. But she was very fond of liquor, and if she got hold of liquor, she'd just drink and drink and drink till she was insensible. And in this condition, several of the local men had sex with her. And then she had a number of hybrid children. And those children survived. Some of those children survived and lived as members of the community. And it was said that they were tall and swarthy, but they looked very human. But they were immensely strong. And her youngest son, Quit, he only died in the 50s. Now, his skull was discovered, and it was kept in Darwin Museum in Moscow. They uncovered his burial place. His skull had quite powerful looking jaws and teeth and a slight brow ridge, but it wasn't prehistoric looking, but it was a little big and a little strange looking. And then there was a Russian cryptozoologist called Igor Burtsev, who brought the skull, and he donated two of the teeth to Professor Sykes's program. Mm. Now, Zana herself died, I think, in about 1890, but quit. We know that she's his skull. So he managed to get mitochondrial DNA from these teeth. Now, mitochondrial DNA is passed down on the mother's side. And the mitochondria are little organelles in the cells that are all to do with the release of energy. And they're passed down purely from the female side. And the DNA he got from them, he said, was sub-Saharan African. And he reckons it's from a pre-Homo sapien. So a hominin, but not Homo sapiens, something more primitive, arising in West Africa and leaving Africa about 100,000 years ago. Whatever these things are, he reckons they're still there in the Caucasus Mountains.
Wow. I mean, I think as the advances go, we're just going to be able to extract more and more information from fairly basic specimens, I think, Richard. And I think the longer we keep digging into this, I think the more astounding discoveries we're going to find.
eDNA is the way to go.
Is that what they're doing with Loch Ness?
That's cool. Yeah. But I think the Loch Ness Monster is mostly explicable in known terms of things like seals and driftwood being pulled by undercurrents and stuff like that, and otters and things like and boat wakes, things like that. But I think some of the sightings may refer to gigantic eels. So if they do the eDNA in Loch Ness and they just find eel DNA along with everything else, nothing will change. Because it'll just be the DNA of a known species, but I think it's just an outsized eel, a fantastically large eel.
Yeah, I think the more you look into Loch Ness, I think once you realise the location, the proximity to the sea, the lochs and everything around it, it's sad to say, but yeah, it's probably it's probably explainable, much to our shame, I would say, sadly. But I think out of all the lake monsters out there, I think Ness is probably the least believable in based purely on the circumstances and the location, Richard.
But the thing is, though, if the Loch Ness Monster, if there's a core selection of sightings that are around a gigantic eel, that's every bit as much as a monster as anything else. Can you imagine an eel 25 to 30 feet long that would take your arm or leg off?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, a fairly standard conger eel is more than enough match for someone underneath the underwater. I've seen several divers who've had the misfortune of coming up far too close for comfort with congers. They are very, very grumpy creatures.
Oh, yes. Yes. And, if you can imagine an eel that large, it would be a highly dangerous animal. And also they can move around on land. They can slither about on land.
Yeah.
And in 2004, an eel said to be 25 feet long was seen in the shallows at Loch Ness.
Wow.
And there have been similar sightings of things elsewhere. I was talking to a lady in Morar, and she ran a guest house in Morar village near Loch Morar, and she's saying, now here there's no tourism like there is at Loch Ness. There's not a visitor centre or people selling t-shirts or toy monsters or anything like that, but people still see weird things. And she told me about a couple of guys from Yorkshire who a couple of years before had come down for a fishing holiday. They'd rented a boat and they'd gone out on it, and they saw what they thought was a dead tree in the water. And as they came closer to it, this dead tree sort of started to thrash around, then looped up and dived under the boat. And it was some huge brownish grey serpentine creature. And they turned and made it back to shore double time and just went home. And the guy that rents the boats, there were two guys that rented the boats back in 1969. They had the animal actually collide with one of their boats. Mm. And I described it as being like this huge eel, about 30 feet long. Mm. The locks in Ireland, most of the sightings there sound like some immensely big eels. Yeah. And they've been seen slithering around on land. And they even call them horse eels in Ireland.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the other thing about eels is that we know, the eunuch eel, if it gets trapped, essentially, because it decides it's not, you know, for whatever reason, it's not willing to breed, its body then suddenly decides, well, if we're not breeding, we'll just get larger, don't they?
Yeah. Well, the theory is, if they're sterile, they haven't got the impetus to go out into the sub-SOC and breed and die. They stay in freshwater getting bigger and bigger and older, and nobody knows how big they get.
Yeah, I mean, what's the average lifespan of an eel, Richard?
You know, I think they live about 5 years, something like that. I mean, I can't remember off the top of my hand. Mm. Sorry, off the top of my head. I can't remember off the top of my head the lifespan of an average eel. But they live in fresh water. Mm. When they get ready to breed, they go out into the Atlantic. This is a European eel. Mm. And they breed in the Sargasso Sea, die, and the babies, called Leptocephalus, they will follow scent trails back to the ancestral freshwaters, and it will go around again. But occasionally you'll get one that just doesn't develop sexually.
Yeah.
So it stays in fresh water.
Mm. Mm. I mean, that's the other aspect to it as well, is the fact it's one of the few species that is equally adept in both fresh and salt water.
Yeah.
Which kind of gives kind of credence to, you know, especially for a lot that have still got sea channels and stuff. And obviously they have to get in and out somehow, regardless, for them to spawn. So I would always tend to suspect that, you know, like you say, finding a new species of giant freshwater eel, yes, it's not, you know, a monster as what some people would describe it, but that would be a monstrous discovery, and it would change a lot of things. Something that, you know, that is known to science, but it's just a specific offshoot that we haven't come across properly yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, another one is the giant anaconda. We know anacondas can grow to about 30 feet, some of them, but there are persistent reports from various areas of tropical South America of anacondas 40, 50, even 60 feet long.
Yeah,
when I went out to hunt for the giant anaconda in Guyana, unfortunately, there was a big drought on, so we couldn't get to the remote lakes where it had been seen. But our guide was a guy called Damon Corrie, and he was he's the chief of the Eagle Clan Arawak tribe, and he said he met these hunters at a place called Corona Falls. And he said they'd seen an anaconda so vast they ran away from it. And he said, how big was it? And they pointed to a palm tree that was about 30 feet long. And they said there was a dead tree in the swamp about that length. And the creature's head and tail, when it slithered by it, stuck out from both ends. So it was 40 foot plus, this snake.
Oh, I mean, the first report I ever heard about giant anacondas, I think, was the infamous explorer Percy Fawcett. I think he was one of the first Western explorers that claimed to have seen a giant anaconda whilst he was on one of his expeditions in South America. And I think people have tried to discredit that report, but Fawcett's writing in general was pretty sturdy stuff. He wasn't one for flights of fancy, looking back. So it's frustrating that certain people will cherry pick things and say, oh, well, that's, you know, he's clearly made that up, when the body of evidence doesn't support that he would make it up.
Well, the thing I find suspicious about his report is that he gives it a length of 60 odd feet, but the girth of it, was only about 12 inches. Now, the skeleton of an anaconda would be bigger than that. Yeah. So either there's been a mistake or a misprint, or he's making it up. Mm. So that's why I don't put much credence in that particular sighting. But there are many others. There's another explorer called S.W. Updegrath, who said he had one beneath his boat, and it was in a great curve underneath his boat. And he said it was at least 50 feet, maybe closer to 60. And these are persistent reports. We still get reports of giant anaconda.
Yeah, absolutely. I know one of the ones I always caught my eye was the petroleum company who were doing some work in the rainforest in the Amazon in Colombia, who came across a giant one which they reckon was about 11 and a half metres long.
Mm.
Which is a terrifying... I mean, we know how large, you know, obviously we look at the snakes that we know in that we can prove to exist, and the anacondas, you know, do get to fairly substantial lengths and widths as well. But, you know, boas and rock pythons, and even, you know, people forget how large a giant cobra is. A terrifying sight in, you know, a fully grown male. I mean, they're up to 16 feet long. So, I once again, I don't understand the limitations of thought in regards to such reports, Richard.
No, neither do I. There was a guy called, he's a pilot called... Remy Van Laird, yeah. He was a decorated fighter pilot from World War II, a hero.
Yeah.
After the war, he flew a charter plane in the Congo. Mm. And he said he was in Katanga in the Congo, and he flew over a clearing, and this immense python came out of a hole in the ground. And he said it was about 50 feet long, and he... His co-pilot managed to snap a picture of it as they flew back across the clearing. And he said it reared up and actually struck at the plane. It reared up 10 feet in the air and struck at the helicopter.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've seen that photo. So, as we mentioned earlier, was one of the things that stayed with me my entire life, because I saw that on Arthur C. Clarke. And I think they interviewed him as well.
They did.
And he was still, you know, 30 years on, he was absolutely adamant that what he had seen, and he, like you say, we've got a decorated, experienced pilot who managed to catch photographic evidence, and the only thing that people ever say is, well, there's nothing for scale. Which I just
Why
find...
would he make something like that?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, when you're a gentleman like that, you know, especially in that era as well, your reputation is everything, Richard.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to get many flights when everybody says, "Oh, should we get a lift with Mad Remy and see what he pretends to see this week?" I mean, and that picture alone, I mean, it's very easily searchable if you look for Remy Van Laird online. It's still baffling because it's an extremely clear picture as well for the time, and to say they were from a helicopter.
Yeah. And we've had natives telling stories of these giant snakes for years.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, is it something that, you know, once again, as we've referred to in regards to hominids and apes, that... I mean, I don't understand, once again, why people just say, oh, it's the attitude that we've discovered everything that there is to find out about the planet. And I don't think anything could be further from the truth, to be honest.
No, even in the days of satellite photography, you can't see through a forest canopy. And there are great swathes of Asia, Africa, the interior of Australia, South America, that's still poorly explored. Even natives don't go there very often. I mean, when I was looking for Orang Pendek on the second expedition, we went to this place, we called it the Lost Valley, and no one had been down it. We met this one old guy who went down there as a boy.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's baffling to me because even we think of recent... situations such as, you know, we know there are lost tribes in the Amazon, we have seen them, so if they can hide out there, and there's probably more than the ones that we're aware of quite easily, you know, I just don't understand why anybody assumes that's it, there's nothing else, when things just like we said about the three new offshoots of hominids that we've discovered over the last 20 years. I think, you know, we've discovered so many different creatures both on land and sea. in that same period, and yet people go, oh, well, you know, these creatures are too big to remain undiscovered.
It's absolute nonsense.
Yeah, plus it kind of goes against what, you know, being a scientist is. The idea of, for me, of a scientist, regardless of which discipline you specialise in, is to search for knowledge and continue to develop the body of work that you're involved in, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. The thing is, back in the Victorian days, there was this ethos of discovery, going out and finding things. And now they're too scared of what their peers think.
Yeah, there is a lot of professional snobbery. I mean, you know, as we referred to, we touched on the Yeti earlier. I mean, you only have to look at, obviously, the photos that were published at the beginning of this week from the Indian Army engineers that have been out on exercises, and they've, you know, published some photos. Everybody said it was a hoax, and so then they released three more, which clearly proved that if it is a hoax, then they've doubled down on it in the first instance.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just beggars belief that people it's been completely dismissed out of hand. Absolutely. I mean, the ridicule that I've seen this week from publications across the world on every continent is like, they're just mucking about.
That's the first thing they go to. Oh, it's a hoax. It's ultimately a hoax. Mm. Now, the thing about cracks in snow is that they can thaw and refreeze and become distorted quite quickly. So tracks in snow are never that good unless they're very, very fresh. They're much better in earth or mud or something like that. So these might not be the tracks of a Yeti. They might be the tracks of a bear. If I was putting money on it, I'd say it was probably a bear, but we don't know for sure. But they're reporting this in good faith.
Yeah.
Even if they are bear tracks, it doesn't mean that the Yeti doesn't exist. Now, if you go onto 14 forums, where everybody seems to kiss the arse of the sceptics and always be agreeing with the sceptics. And if you did go out and do any actual research, and these people that are always kissing the arses of the sceptics, they don't go out and do any research. But if you do research, they sort of, you know, pillory you, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like you can't win.
Yeah.
I mean, there's several incidents where, I mean, it beggars belief for me that, so, you know, someone can be so dismissive out of hand. It's like reports of sea serpents, that there is a train of thought that what people have seen are oarfish, which don't behave anything like
nothing like them. They're silvery coloured and they have a red crest.
Yep.
That's no sea serpent description is like that.
No,
it's just laziness.
Yeah, it is. It's like a one size fits all. There's a brilliant podcast I listen to called Monsters Among Us, and there was a guy that had rung in with a sea serpent sighting, and it was quite compelling. And then somebody the week after rang up and basically said, "Oh yeah, it's an oarfish," and then just made loads of stuff up about oarfish, do it about the threshing movements, and just basically created an explanation that was based on complete fabrication, because everything he was saying all this oarfish did was not, there was zero evidence of it, and he was saying, oh yeah, it's really common. And I just found it incredible that someone would go out of their way just to make absolute nonsense up that if anything was more ludicrous than the story that he was trying to disprove.
Yeah, oftentimes the explanations are more stupid and unbelievable than actually saying, yeah, this animal is there.
Because every time I see a programme about sea monsters or lake monsters or something, and as soon as somebody mentions oarfish, oh, there's just a feeling that comes over me, Richard. I can't describe it.
And another thing that I've got to look for, the Tasmanian wolf, the thylacine, flesh-eating marsupial, dog-like marsupial in Tasmania. Since its official extinction in the mid-30s, there's been over 4,000 sightings of it, including by a zoologist and a park ranger. Well, I've been over there three times now, and I've talked to people like a government licensed shooter who goes down killing the feral cats.
Yeah.
And he's seen it twice. An old ex-logger, he saw it back in the 50s, and his son saw it just the year before.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of other sort of guy worked on a hydroelectric scheme in the 1970s, and he said he was driving to work once. There was five people in this car, and he said one of these things just came out in the road in front of them, and they all saw it.
Yeah.
All of them saw it.
Yeah.
You know, close up. It's not a fleeting thing dashing off into the bush.
Yeah.
And there was a guy called Professor Henry Nix.
Mm.
And he was a biologist from a university in Australia who developed this system called BioClim. It was a program used as a tool to assist zoologists in looking for animals.
Yeah.
And what you did, you program all of your information on the animal into a computer. Then you program all the geographical information of your area. Then you match the two up, and it will say where your target animal is most likely to be seen in this target area.
Mm.
So if you were looking for white rhinos in Botswana, where would you find them?
Yeah.
And it would match the two. Now, he, just as an exercise, he did that with the Tasmanian wolf.
Yeah.
And he found out that about 98% of reported sightings were from the very areas that his computer program was suggesting that thylacines should be in Tasmania if they were still around.
Mm. Yeah, I mean... It's one of those things. I'm a massive believer. I think there's been far too many reports from people that spend a lot of time outside. I remember seeing an interview with one chap who lived in the bush in Tasmania, and he was absolutely adamant that he had several encounters with them at night, and as usual, somebody who had never been to the area said, "Oh, he's probably seen a dingo." Well, I think he's going to know
the
difference.
There are no dingoes in Tasmania. There are no dingoes in Tasmania.
Well, exactly, and that was the thing. And I thought, well, firstly, I've never heard. To be fair, that would probably be more surprising than a Tasmanian wolf.
Yeah.
And I think it's just one of those things. And like you say, Richard, once something comes out, a lot of people just say, "Oh, well, it's that." This is the explanation. There is nothing further to do. And you think, well, sometimes the explanation is more baffling than the actual supposed creature.
Yeah. When I was in India, looking for the Yeti in India, I was talking to hill tribes, and they were all describing this creature with covered in black hair, looking very like an upright gorilla, about 3 meters tall. They all dovetailed. They were saying it was shaking the bushes and roaring, and it making a threat display similar to gorillas do,
yeah,
to intimidate. Yeah. And then also one guy said he saw it making a huge nest. He was on a hill, and he saw this thing making a huge nest. And none of these people, you know, they weren't after money. They're getting nothing to gain by telling these stories.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, well, that's the same. You can draw exactly the same parallel with, you know, the indigenous Australians, Native Americans. These stories go back eons in both those particular cultures. And I would imagine, you know, things like the Almasti and the Yeren and the Yeti is exactly the same thing. And it's just that it's like that piecemeal approach to people tend to say, oh, well, The indigenous populations were right about this, but they're clearly wrong about this. And I find that very frustrating.
And why would they be making these stories up?
Well, exactly.
Why on earth?
They've got nothing to gain from it.
And they're clearly not allegorical stories. Mm. They're stories of people seeing creatures in the same way they see other wild animals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and for them, like you say, in regards to how certain people view the Almasti as part, for them, they are, you know, part of the natural fauna of their area. As far as they're concerned, they know what they are, they know their habits, their locations, and for a lot of them, they keep out of the way, don't they?
Yeah.
Because if, you know, if anything, you know, they'd be running around trying to get them, because they obviously know that there's an interest out there, Richard. So it would be in their benefit, probably financially. And I'm sure somebody unscrupulous may try to take advantage of certain people. But that again shows that they don't want to take that risk, and they're quite happy living alongside.
Mm. And also there's this thing called the missilization process. Bernard Heuvelman wrote about that. Mm. There were stories of gorillas in ancient times, stories of gorillas tearing branches off trees and using them to beat elephants to death, and coming into villages and taking away native girls and raping them. And the gorillas don't do these things, but gorillas exist. Yeah. So sometimes they have bizarre beliefs attached to them.
Mm. Mm.
It's the same with
the
Mongolian death worm.
Mm.
I went to look for the Mongolian death worm back in 2005, and fingers crossed, knock on formica, I might be going out later in the year to look for it again. And I went for something like 1,000 miles through the desert there and talked to the nomads. And in the West here, we hear these stories of the Mongolian death worm shooting blasts of electricity. And and they say it doesn't do that. That's just folklore. Mm. They call it throwing lightning. They didn't do that. They believe it can spit poison and they're frightened of it.
Mm.
But they say it doesn't do this electricity thing. That's just folklore. Mm. But I talked to about 24 witnesses who had seen it, you know, from the 1930s right up to the year before we were there. And we talked to this one guy who had seen it when he was tending his family's livestock as a youth. He'd seen this thing in the desert, and he told his family, and they just packed up their gear, the circular tents they have, and all their livestock, and moved out of the area. It can send a whole area into a panic when one of these things is seen. Lots of people talked to park wardens that had seen them. We talked to an old retired army colonel that had seen one coiled up in the desert. And it seems to be that it's not a worm at all, but some sort of burrowing reptile. Maybe a worm lizard, an amphisbaena, or possibly some form of sand boa.
Mm.
Now, in Somalia, there's a type of sand boa, and they call it the apris locally. Yeah. And the local people believe it's so deadly, so poisonous, it doesn't even have to bite you to kill you. If you just touch it, you'll die. Ooh. But in fact, it's completely harmless. It's a constrictor, and it feeds on small mammals like mice.
Yeah.
And it's about 3 feet long. And I think the death worm is something similar.
I mean, there's nothing to say that it's not some kind of snake at all, really, Richard, because it's not, obviously, you know, certain parts of it have been exaggerated. I mean, I first became aware of the Mongolian death worm when I read Carl Schucker's book, The Beast That Hide From Men, which is a fabulous book. That was probably the first real report that I've read about the Mongolian death worm. So it's one of those creatures that we know in that particular genus of reptiles that there are creatures that burrow under sand, there are creatures that can spit venom, there are creatures that have venomous bites. So what's to say that it's, and you know, and the Gobi Desert is a vast expanse of land with hardly anybody in it other than a few nomadic tribes, really. Who's to say that there isn't an undiscovered species of boa or another type of snake out there that matches those behaviours?
Absolutely.
It's
sometimes these weird stories turn out to have truth in them. There's a South American tree frog called the giant monkey tree frog, and the local people said that its secretions make you invisible in the jungle, and they negate hunger and thirst. When biochemists looked at these secretions, they found out that they did negate feelings of hunger and thirst in humans, and they also masked the human scent, effectively making you invisible in the jungle.
Yeah. Wow.
The hero shrew of the Congo, so called because the story said it's so strong it can support the weight of a man on its back, and witch doctors used to have its pelt on their belts to give them strength. It turns out that it's got a network of reinforced bones in its back that form like a grid. And no one knows why it's got this. Other shrews that live in the same area don't have it, but it can indeed support the weight of a man on its back. The pitahui of New Guinea, the garbage bird, it's supposed to be a venomous bird. If it pecked or clawed you, you'd come out in a terrible sore rash. No one believed it because there's no such thing as a venomous bird. But when they took a closer look, they found it does have a venomous secretion. And it wipes it can wipe its beak and claws in this secretion, and it will cause intense irritation.
I mean, you only have to look at, the duck-billed platypus, for instance, is a venomous animal, which hardly anybody realises. They all think, oh, look at these wonderfully strange, cute creatures. But they're quite adept little predators, to be fair.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I've seen one in the wild. They're amazing when you see them in the wild. I saw one down in Tasmania. But that was thought to be... It's thought to be a complete hoax.
I think the first specimen was sent over to the Natural History Museum, they thought somebody was taking the Michael, didn't they? Thought it was just because it is, if you look at it on face value, it's a very odd looking creature or cute, depending on your point of view, Richard. But they've just dismissed it out of hand as one of a curiosity. But yet we know it's there and it exists. I mean, you look at Komodo dragons. I mean, they're phenomenal creatures. I mean, up to, 10 foot long?
With a
highly venomous bite, and obviously will know, if they're in the mood, they will fancy tackling anything.
Now, in prehistoric times, the Komodo dragon had a relative called Megalania prisca, which lived on mainland Australia, that was 30 feet long. A lizard the size of a bus, 30 feet long, with a venomous bite. Now, there are stories in New Guinea of giant lizards bigger than anything seen today, anything known, approaching the same size as a big crocodile, 30 feet. And there's a theory that Megalania or something like it, or something related to it, is living in the dense jungles of New Guinea.
It's like you referred to earlier, Richard. There are some areas of this planet that are hardly touched upon, primarily because there doesn't seem to be any monetary value there most of the time, which I suppose is a good thing. And I just find it incredible that people just go, there can't be anything else out there, or it's simply too big. When we know things, animals especially, are extremely adept. The reason most of them live to a certain age is that they're very adept at hiding and camouflage and looking for the best way to survive. They're not going to be wandering around going, hello, here I am, please, recognize I'm a new species. That the reason these creatures have survived so long is because they keep out of the way.
Exactly.
So as you refer to there about going out, so is that your next planned trip, hopefully, then, Richard, going back out to Mongolia?
Well, I'm involved with this project with a couple of American guys who are, and they're doing an international cryptozoology documentary and going all around the world with different people. So they're just talking to their financiers at the minute, so I'm just waiting to see if this comes off or not. Got my fingers crossed.
Oh, I've got them crossed for you as well, Richard. That'd be outstanding. What's that called? Is that going to be a series or a film?
It's just one long documentary.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's the kind of programme I could sit down and watch no matter how long it is, sadly for my partner, as I proved recently, I can sit down and watch anything. That sounds fantastic. So is it just basically travelling around the world looking after all one...
Going with different people to different parts of the world looking for different cryptids.
Oh, fantastic. That sounds brilliant. Yeah, fantastic. So, other than these wonderful creatures, you're also a key member of the Centre for Thought... of Forfortian Zoology, based here in the UK. So how did you get there working with them, Richard, and what's about the 40 and
Well, I was originally I stumbled across their magazine, their journal, Animals and Men. It was in the shop at Potter's Museum of Curiosities, which is a sadly now defunct collection of weird Victorian taxidermy that was being held at the Jamaica Inn in Cornwall. And I got this magazine, read it. It was a really good magazine, subscribed to it. I was at Leeds University at the time. I started having conversations with John Downes, the director, and wrote a few articles for him. And he said, "When you finish at university, come down, and we'll have you as the zoological director." So I came down, joined the CFZ, and since then I've been all over the world hunting all kinds of monsters.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, it is a growing organisation as well, because obviously you've got there's an American branch and there's an Australian branch as well, isn't there?
Yeah, and there's a Canadian branch and a New Zealand branch.
Yeah, it's a bit like a who's who of cryptozoology when you have a look about who's in it. There's
Yeah.
many a name I recognise, both here and abroad. So, I mean, what's next there? Is it continuing to develop the team and move forwards?
Yeah, we did it ran for 17 years. We did this thing called the Weird Weekend, which was a 40ian conference down in Devon. And now it's moved up to a place called Rixton with Glazebrook, which is a village just south of Manchester. And it's called Weird Weekend North now. So it's changed venues, but it's still going. And that's a great weekend if you can ever get to it. It's real good fun. And we've got a publishing arm as well. We publish 40ian books. We do our expeditions.
Yeah, no, it's
But
brilliant.
it's all that, in the end, it's all down to the green folding stuff. If we had more finances, we could do more. Because when I go on these expeditions, I might go over 2 or 3 weeks once a year. Now, what you really need to be doing, if you're looking for the Tasmanian wolf or the orang pendek or anything like that, you've got to be out there for months and months. Snow leopards, when they first went out to try and film snow leopards in the wild, it took them something like 7 years to film snow leopards in the wild. So that can, that sort of shows you how long it can take. And with very limited resources, there's only so much you can do. But if we had more resources, we'd get more done. I mean, if I ever won the lottery, I'd plough most of it back into cryptozoology, and I can guarantee you within my lifetime we'd have found three or four of these things at least.
Yeah, absolutely.
You
I've
think
always
the
I've...
skeptics as well, they don't seem to realise that. They don't seem to realise that, the people that are doing this, are doing it with their own forces because
Yeah.
they think it deserves to be done. I mean, I've had some arseholes accuse me of just doing it because I want an expensive foreign holiday. Well, I've been stalked by tigers, attacked by cobras, covered in leeches, covered in ticks, fell down an ice crevasse, fell off a cliff, nearly been swept away by rapids. It's hard, dangerous, time-consuming, and it devours money. We do this because it needs to be done. Not for any egotistical purposes or not for having expensive foreign holidays.
Yeah, well, to be fair, I mean, it's ludicrous to suggest that kind of thing. And I think, I'm of exactly the same mind, Richard. I've always said if I won the lottery, that'd be it. I would gladly support any venture you wanted to do, sir. I'd be a modern day Tom Slick, because I think we need somebody like him again, because he was
Yeah.
someone who did so much work for cryptozoology in the 40s and 50s, and it's a shame there's not more like him.
Yeah, and what a great name for an oil millionaire as well, Tom Slick.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, exactly.
I wish there were more like him.
Yeah, because I know he did a lot of work with Ivan Sanderson, didn't he, and Bernard
Yeah, and Peter
Hoverman's
Burr. Yeah.
a lot of expeditions, especially he was big into the Yeti and I think Macaulay Mbembe as well, wasn't he? So he certainly put his money where his mouth was. Yeah, so You've got your new book coming out next month as well, Richard, I believe, Adventures in Cryptozoology. Yeah. So is
it
this...
comes out, yeah, in the States, it comes out on the 31st of March, and then it's available from mid-June in the UK. It's called Adventures in Cryptozoology Volume 1, because the publishers, Mango Publications, split the book into two volumes.
Oh.
So the first volume is an introduction to cryptozoology, a look at the various animals that used to be cryptids but are now well known, like gorillas and giant squids and Komodo dragons. Yeah. A look at the history of cryptozoology, and it looks at dragon sightings of dragon-like creatures around the world, sea serpents and lake monsters and mystery primates. Yeah. And then the second volume looks at other kinds of cryptids, things like creatures that are supposed to be extinct but maybe still about, like the Tasmanian wolf. Mm. It looks at giant anacondas and giant crocodiles and other things like that. And then it catalogues my own expeditions, my own experiences in the field. And then it finally tells you what to do if you want to set up your own cryptozoological expedition.
Ah, excellent. So when's the second volume due out then?
That will be either the end of the year or early next year.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like a perfect book, because is this your fifth book now?
These will be my seventh and eighth book.
Right. Excellent. Fantastic. So have you got anything else in the pipeline? Is this all done and dusted and copy with the editor now and that's
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's all done and dusted, that is, yeah.
Yeah, so have you got another project lined up? Anything tantalising you? Your talents, Richard, where you go next?
I might be going out to look for horse eels, the giant eels in Connemara in Ireland. I might be going there.
Fantastic. Is that through the CFZ or is that...
No, that's with another project with a different American company that might be wanting to go out and hunt for huge eels.
Oh, fantastic. So... I mean, is there, in regards to, you know, how we look at this then, Richard, obviously we've kind of mentioned right at the beginning, we were talking about, you know, my opinion that, you know, we're not far away from possibly looking at anything. And I mentioned the Oran Pendek as one that's probably going to pop up sooner rather than later. And in regards to, you know, conclusive proof that there is something else there. Is there anything else you think we're tantalizingly close to proving or is there anything that you think deserves far more scrutiny and investigation than perhaps has been spent on it so far?
I think the Tasmanian wolf is another one that's going to be found.
Yeah.
I think recent fossil and DNA evidence are suggesting that the Yeti and the Almasti and these neo-men, these wild men, have a basis in truth. I think... things like giant crocodilians, giant crocodiles and giant anacondas, outsized reptiles are something to be looked into as well. Another project I want to do is go around the world trying to film the world's biggest crocodile. Oh. There are stories of these huge outsized crocodiles. There's one from a river in New Guinea where it's worshipped as a sort of god, a protective deity, this monstrous crocodile. There's another one from East India, this immense crocodile, and another one from called Potol that lives in a Gusan marsh in the Philippines, which is a feared man-eater. And then there's the infamous Gustav of Lake Tanganyika in Africa. He's killed fully grown hippopotamus.
is something. I mean, Gustav is probably the most famous crocodile in the world, I think, purely because of his notoriety. Because he's supposed to be a pretty fierce piece of work.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, an average-sized Nile crocodile will take down a lion.
Mm.
An average-sized saltwater crocodile will take down a tiger.
Mm.
So when you scale this up, and you're dealing with a truly terrifying animal.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, I mean, the biggest one that's been on record so far was Lolong.
That's the biggest one in captivity.
Yeah, I mean, well,
it was
obviously.
20 feet. Yeah. The biggest one measured, biggest one actually measured was 28 feet 4 inches.
Mm. Yeah, was that salty or was it just a...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they can get pretty hefty as well. I know. I think I think I can remember watching the program, which was dealing with a village, and I think it was somewhere, might have been the Philippines, that were being terrorized by a giant crocodile. It might be the one when they ended up catching Lolo.
But yes, everybody, that was it.
Yeah, but everybody in the village after they caught it was saying, "Well, yeah, but that's not the what we've seen."
Yeah. They said it was much bigger and it was much darker. The scales were much darker.
Yeah, which I just found both intriguing and terrifying at the same time, because I find them fascinating creatures, because they're just just perfect killing machines.
With a bite three times more powerful than a great white shark.
Yeah, and they're just so quick. Wonderful creatures.
Yeah, but once again, it's all down to funding.
Yeah. Well, certainly tantalising. Well, Richard, listen, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. I could keep you all day, but I know you've got a heavy cold and I'm sure you've got other things to do. So where can everybody find your work? Where's the best place to follow your work and the Centre for Fortean Zoology and
books? The Centre for Fortean Zoology website, which is www.cfz.org.uk. And my book, you can pre-order it online. Just go onto Amazon and type in Adventures in Cryptozoology and you'll get it. And you'll find all my other books up there as well.
Brilliant, obviously. And you're still writing for Fortean Times as well?
Yes, I just had an article in the last issue about the Caspian Tiger.
Oh.
Why I did a recent expedition to Tajikistan to look for relic hominids known as the Ghul. Oh. Locally, and we met a lot of people that had seen these creatures called Ghul, which are quite distinct from the Almasti, very different indeed. But also we met a lot of people that had seen the Caspian Tiger. The Caspian Tiger is supposed to have died out in the 1960s or early 70s.
Yeah.
Now, we talked to many witnesses, including a park ranger who had seen one just a month before. We had people tell us that they'd seen them with cubs. We had people tell us that they'd been taking livestock, that they'd seen them kill deer. Farmers, hunters, beekeepers had all seen these creatures. Mm-hmm. And they were adamant that these weren't leopards or snow leopards. They knew the difference. These were tigers. Mm-hmm. And they identified it from pictures. Mm-hmm. And when I got back to England, I wrote to every single tiger conservation group I could find, detailing this information.
Yeah.
And only one of them got back to me. And the one that got back to me said, "Oh, we only deal with the Siberian tiger." Just ignored. Completely ignored. Now, if there's a chance that the Caspian tiger is still around, you'd think that tiger conservation groups would be interested.
Yeah.
But none of them graced me with an answer, except for the one that said, "We only deal with the Siberian tiger."
I don't know. Sometimes it's so frustrating, Richard, it really is. But hopefully things will continue to develop and change as those of us that are believers in such things constantly find evidence that knocks another go-to excuse from a sceptic appearing in it more and more. So once again, thank you so much for your time today, Richard. It's been an absolute pleasure and all the very best for the book. And we'll speak again soon. You take care.
And you. Thanks a lot.
Welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.